If you'd please sit down, sir. We're starting the next debate, and if you'd turn your attention to the proposition. We're going to be talking about Made in China 2025. And the proposition is that this program, Made in China 2025, and China's broader industrial policy pose a threat to global innovation and the world economy. So if you'd all start registering your votes in support of or against this proposition, I will give you a brief introduction. Beijing has undertaken a strategic effort aimed at comprehensively upgrading Chinese industry. And at the heart of this effort is this program, Made in China 2025. The initiative was launched in 2015. It is designed to increase manufacturing capability and technological innovation within key industries. Robotics, electric cars, artificial intelligence are among those industries that are listed as priorities under the plan. While touted by Beijing as a blueprint aimed at transforming China into an advanced manufacturing leader, some observers have argued that the Made in China 2025 program gives China an unfair advantage in the global economy and threatens innovation. To discuss China's industrial program and these concerns in more detail, we have to my right my colleague, Professor Scott Kennedy, formerly professor, we'll just call you doctor now, Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS. And to my left is Dr. Mu Rongping, who's Director General of the Center for Innovation and Development at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. So each of you, once again, will have 15 minutes to argue your position, and then each will have 5 minutes to rebut the other. So we will start with Scott Kennedy, who is arguing in favor of the proposition.
Terrific. Well, Bonnie, thank you very much for including me in today's discussions, and congratulations on running such a terrific conference now in its third year, and I'm sure it will run for many more years, and it's really exciting to participate today. It's also an honor to be sharing the stage with Mu Rongping. He's one of China's leading authorities on technology policy. He has played a role for many years in shaping Chinese economic policies, and so is extremely well informed. And I actually know that we agree on a lot more than what's going to be reflected in today's discussions. I'm going to make 4 broad points. The first is about what I'm not saying and what I'm not arguing for. The second is to give a little bit more description about what Made in China 2025 is. Third, what I find problematic and threatening about Made in China 2025 and China's industrial policies more broadly. And lastly, what the threats are of these policies to innovation and the global economy. So first, what I'm not saying. I am not arguing that Chinese economic development is bad for China and for the world. Actually, it's very important for China and very helpful for the world. I just don't think Chinese industrial policy has been the main reason for China's economic successes and those elements of its global engagement that are genuinely win-win. I'm not arguing that all industrial policy is a threat or that China couldn't potentially have an industrial policy program that was less of a threat and more constructive. It could, but it doesn't. I'm not arguing that Chinese industrial policy is inevitably in conflict with the rules of the WTO and China's other international commitments. I am not a lawyer, and this is not a discussion about legal issues. It's a question about economic consequences. If you want the legal case, go down the street to the USTR. I am not arguing that all US companies have lost as a result of Chinese industrial policy. Actually, some make a lot of money precisely because of Chinese industrial policy, but they are the exceptions to the rule. And in any case, the threat that Made in China 2025 poses are only partly about the effects on individual companies in the United States or elsewhere. The question we're discussing today is about the effect on the global innovation ecosystem and the global economy more generally. I'm not arguing that Chinese industrial policy is at the root of all of America's economic problems, and that would be facile, and we know that that's not true, but it's a contributor. And I'm not arguing that there's no innovation in China. What I will argue is that innovation in China is extremely inefficient, and those inefficiencies in its approach to technology are damaging to others. And lastly, I'm not arguing, at least yet, that because of the threat to the United States and the global economy that Chinese industrial policy poses, that we should disengage from China or have a tariff war or contain China. The danger posed by China's policies don't justify any and all means to counter them. The U.S. and others have to be smart about how to proceed. So that's what I'm not arguing for. What should we say and how should we describe Made in China 2025? Now, Vice Premier Liu He has said that he's not read Made in China 2025. Well, if he wants, I'd be happy to share a copy with him. But he needs to read a lot more than that, because Made in China 2025 is part of a large complex of Chinese industrial policies. China really began to focus heavily on industrial policies in 2006 when it came out with its medium and long-term range policies on technological development. And that was the first time we heard the idea of indigenous innovation. And I think Mu Rongping is very familiar with that since he participated in that conversation back then. In 2009, China came forth with its plan for strategic emerging industries, 34 industries in 7 categories that it wanted to make much stronger in China. In 2015, as Bonnie said, China came out with its Made in China 2025 plan, which was later endorsed by the Chinese State Council and has appeared in hundreds, if not thousands, of speeches by Chinese leaders, and was included in the 2016 13th five-year plan, which includes not just the Made in China 2025 plan, but many other industrial policy plans as well. So actually, I think it's important that we understand that Made in China 2025 is an important plan. It's not the only plan. And really, if you want to understand Chinese industrial policy as a whole, you should look at all of the plans and how they are interconnected. Well, what is problematic about these plans and industrial policy? First of all, the goals of Made in China 2025 are quite clear. Two of them stand out. The first is import substitution. China has set specific targets for Chinese companies to gain market share in these technologies up and down the supply chain within China, and then have Chinese companies export abroad. Now, yes, it's okay. That is a lot more than saying China needs to be a member of these sectors in different parts of the supply chain, but it's talking about Chinese domination in these industries. The second is national security. China's obviously pursuing these not just because it's going to increase Chinese productivity, but it's going to make the Chinese PLA stronger, give China more power in the military realm as well. So, and I think that, you know, China, the most common word that you hear, and it's part of the question today, is innovation. I think every Chinese official I've met in the last decade uses the word innovation all the time and give me lots of lectures about China's pursuit of innovation. But I think actually what Chinese policy is really directed toward is technological development and acquisition of technologies, whether they are invented in China or not. Xi Jinping has many times referred to these goals and in ways that I think we ought to be concerned about. I'll give you a couple quotes. First, he recently said, "Self-reliance is the basis for the struggle of the Chinese nation to stand on its own footing in the world. Self-innovation is the only way for us to climb the world's technological peaks." Another quote, "Core technology in the cyberspace is our largest vulnerability. Core technology being controlled by others is our largest hidden weakness. No matter how big an internet firm is in size or market cap, if the supply of core components relies on foreign countries, that will be like building a house on other people's foundations." So the first concern that we ought to have are the goals of Made in China 2025. The second are the tools. The subsidies, which number in the trillions, limits to market access, local content requirements, distinctive standards, all policies which obviously don't create a level playing field in China and potentially beyond. They're deeply distortionary and discriminatory. Now, why does this matter? Lots of countries have had industrial policy, and they haven't driven the world economy over the edge or created massive problems. The problem with China doing it is simple. It's scale, the size of China. China doing this means that China's market distortions become global market distortions, and that could be damaging far beyond China's borders. So this isn't a question about my concern about internal Chinese economic policies because what it might mean for China. It's really about what it means for everybody else as well. Now, what are the ways in which the policies are a threat to innovation and to the global economy? The first, which may be actually least important, is the question of market access that is denied foreign companies in China, which then affects their profitability in China and globally. Given how quickly China is growing, it should be a huge source of profits for companies if you had a level playing field. The second is jobs. China is the world's manufacturing powerhouse. Everyone goes there to manufacture. That is not a natural result of just simply China having smart people who work hard for long hours. That is true, but it is also a result of specific Chinese industrial policies which have attracted companies to relocate to China and move from quote-unquote less competitive markets. And that has affected job opportunities everywhere. As Bonnie alluded to, I was a professor. I spent 15 years in Indiana. And I you won't believe this, but on Sundays I played basketball. Not very well. And I remember getting elbowed in the head a lot from my colleagues on the court who used to work at Otis Elevator. Otis Elevator was bought by United Technologies and is now produces everywhere but in the United States, including a lot of factories in China. And so, you know, obviously the U.S. at 3.7% unemployment, you wouldn't say that this is a big problem, but look at the nature of employment in the United States and the type of jobs people have and the type of benefits that they have and the growing gap between rich and poor, and you'd have to say that that large sucking sound from China in terms of jobs has had an effect on the gap between rich and poor here. But the bigger effect on for jobs is not in the United States, it's in other developing countries in Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America that have had more difficulty finding space in global production networks. And they are primarily now providing raw materials and commodities to the Chinese manufacturing machine. And that is damaging. The third problem is volatility. Chinese industrial policy ends up drawing huge amounts of resources in waves into different industries. And these market distortions end up affecting everybody. You see lots of price volatility in China, both up and down, that then are translated into commodity markets elsewhere and into final product goods markets. Chinese overcapacity becomes a source of price declines and problems for companies that try to make a living that don't have the type of financial resources that Chinese companies have. And then you see dumping by Chinese companies to deal with that domestic overcapacity problem. There's lots of examples of these. The steel industry, aluminum industry, solar, wind, all have suffered because of Chinese industrial policies. What's coming next? Electric vehicles. We just published a report last week about China's movement in electric vehicles. China's the world's largest maker. There's not going to be enough demand in China for electric vehicles that they're producing. They're going to probably dump those on the global market. That's going to have a huge effect on the global auto industry. Then, in addition to that, you'll have problems with robotics, memory chips, and other sectors if this strategy continues. Then I think you also ought to look at the Belt and Road, which is exporting China's industrial policy system. Not just airports, roads, ports, but also the model in which China uses to advance industries. In China, I think we used to hear about ghost cities. Well, imagine if Chinese investment is enough along the Belt and Road, you may get ghost countries, lots of bridges and roads to nowhere. The fourth problem, cheap intellectual property. China does have coercive tech transfer requirements for many industries in China. Some sectors, such as electric vehicles, have legal requirements that you hand over technology to form a joint venture in China. But in most instances, these mandatory requirements are just standard operating procedure that local officials use when deciding who to approve to do business in their locality. Of course, there's also theft of IP and commercial secrets. And in the United States, China accounts for 80% of IP theft. Finally, there's the question of data and the way that China collects data, processes data, applies data. Obviously, in the China market, there's unequal access to data. Foreign companies can't get their hands on a lot of it. I think people here have probably by now not only heard of Made in China 2025, but you've also probably heard of China's social credit system and how that is applying data in all realms of life and how eventually all of you may have a social credit score that the Chinese create. You know about broader surveillance that China applies high technology to in Xinjiang and is moving to other parts of China. You know about the weaknesses of China's privacy protection regimes with regard to data. You know about problems with patient rights in China. I think just about everybody now has heard of the story about Dr. Hu Jiankun and what he's done with gene editing and creating a CRISPR baby. Now, that's been universally condemned in China by Chinese scientists and the government, but his work emerged in the context of a feverish investment in all different types of medical and biotechnologies. And China is trying to export this approach. Huawei is investing in safe cities and smart cities around the world. China is obviously trying to roll out the digital Silk Road. And China's, just think about China's autonomous vehicle project, which is run by Baidu, called the Apollo Project. Imagine when Baidu tries to export its autonomous vehicle strategy to many other countries. Who do you think is going to get to see that data and use that data? Finally, it's going to create a lot of competitive pressures on other companies to cooperate with the Chinese and follow suit, even when they're not doing business directly with the Chinese. So last point, and I know I've gone a little bit long, is there is innovation in China. I'm not trying to deny that. And China is very important in helping scale up new technologies and reducing the cost of innovation. But innovations in China often lead to second best outcomes for everybody. If you look at solar panels, the type of solar panels which now are dominant in the world are dominant because China scaled those up. There is a lot better solar technology that the world could have, but we have locked into a certain kind of solar technology which is second best. The same is occurring with lithium ion batteries and electric vehicles. There could be much better technologies than those, but because of the way China is innovating and scaling up, we may never see those technologies on the market. So in sum, the larger China gets, the larger these distortions will become for everybody, and the greater damage it will cause to innovation and to the global economy. Thank you.
The results of our initial polling on this proposition, which you have before you, on China's broader industrial policy and Made in China 2025 posing a threat to global innovation and the world economy, was 30% yes and 70% no. So a bit skewed, and we'll see if we're going to get that closer or make that gap even wider. Over to you, Dr. Mu Rongting, please.
Dear friends, colleagues, and ladies and gentlemen, it's my honor to join in these events to share my observation and my understanding about these questions and these issues. So just Scott, I think you have very good questions and very good suggestions for us. So I think China is, you know, catching up countries, is a very good student. We always try to identify advantage and the good things the other country have made. So during the past 40 years, when China made open door policies, so we try to learn. So today, this morning, I find lots of debate. Maybe the key questions or problem is China catching up too fast. So I think there's so this is lots of common between the two countries. I think China and United States, the two countries are great countries. China is an biggest developing countries in the world with a very long, glorious history. And United States is the biggest developed countries and with and a profound influence in the world. That is the two countries. And during the past years, we have based our observation, the two countries, especially during the past 20 or 40 years, when China open door policies, we get a lot of opportunities collaborate with United States and the many other countries. So we all agree there is a big gap in many perspectives between China and the US. The gap in GDP per capita, and China per capita, GDP per capita is about 15% of that the US in 2017. And in science, technology, and innovation capacity in particular. So in China, this morning, your senator said China is goes so fast in 5G and is so advanced. But in China, very often we talk about how advanced that in United States. So that is the difference. So we have to talk about this issue based on some the data or some indicator or some pure discussions. And of course, look at the Nobel lieutenants, every year United States have. But in China, we have. But many years ago, the work done by some scientists. So we all agree that Chinese Americans want to have the high quality jobs and prosperity's future. So, so lots of Chinese know the story of America dream. This is not so popular. And some even come to America to experience American dream. I would want to say there is also a lot of stories of Chinese dream. Very similar. They work hard and they try their best to find new way their life. This is what I want to say before I come to the questions. So there are lots of forum and conference nowadays in China to review the success of the reform and open door policies and try to find the new potential and new way of next 30 years reform and openings. So that is the question relating to today's. So so that is as lots of success stories. I want to say some. I'm personally an observer of this change. I got my PhD in Germany, so I learned my English in German. Sorry. Of Deutsch. A large number of, so you can find China has transformed its economic system, from central planning economy to the market economy, although many people say still you are not so well transformed, but we changed. Compared to 40 years ago, this big change. And China has become an open economic system. Nowadays you can find 140 million foreigners visit China annually, growth increased steadily. And a large number of successful private entrepreneurs, such as Liu Chuanzhi and Jack Ma, emerged. You cannot imagine before. And the gap and the urbanization rate is also increased very fast because of these reform and open door policies. So based on this previous background, I would like to say I don't think that Made in China 2025 and the related industry program pose a threat to global innovation and the world economy. Based several points, I would bring some of them, 6 points. Made in China 2025 is a policy to promote the transformation and upgrading of manufacturers, setting a vision for manufacturing sectors by 2035 in China, and with some predictive and guiding indicators. So I would like to explain why we such an ambitious goals. This is Chinese tradition culture. Because in China, we always raise a relatively high goals. This is and achieve half of it are also satisfied. This is so to some extent we can say China is a vision-driven country. So we always, during the past years, especially since 1990, China raised the goal, want to realize the full modernization in 1960s. And in 1982, the Deng Xiaoping raised a goal, way of society by 2000. And 2002, we have new way, we want to go follow the new way of industrializations. 2003, and scientific outlook for development. And 2004, and resource saving and human-friendly society. And 2005, humanized society. 2006, want to build innovation-driven country. And 2012, the eco-civilization society. So this kind of vision drive China to make change. That is to some extent is also innovations. But when we talk about these issues, the major concern is change China, to change Chinese life, to change their thinking ways. So that is the first point. Second point, Made in China 2025 provide public informations for the stakeholders, not only the big companies, but also small, and also public research institutes and the universities. I think that is very important. This process to make such an programs or the policies is more important than the result. Because in the process, different stakeholders, they discuss about the future to make consensus, to try and find their opportunities and to adjust their middle long term the development strategies. This is also makes sense to provide more opportunity for the people. I mean, the high quality job and the services for the societies. And the third one, Made in China 2025 has learned a lot from the other countries. So we learn always during the past 40s. We learn, for example, American innovation strategy. Yeah, you have initiated some, you know, programs. So the manufacturer innovation system institutes. So Manufacture 2025 in China also have such a manufacturer innovation center. This, I think, this concept directly borrowed from your American innovation strategy. And also many other countries, Industry 4.0 and the Japanese, the Society 5.0. This has a new concept. This is the knowledge shared by the world. And the fourth point is Made in China 2025 is a market-oriented, open and inclusive action plan. Abide by the provisions of the WTO and the treat domestic and foreign company equality. And I think this is the Professor Scott mentioned lots of things. I think, for example, FDI come to China, why? That I think they don't want to enjoy the policies. We also conducted the survey several years ago. The major concern is the local market, not the policies. Yeah. So that's and also the over capacity issues. I think this is the market mechanism can solve these kind of problems if they are over capacity. Then some company will disappear after several years competition. And the debt flow, I think, is the same. Yeah. Even within China, the debt flow is the issue, is the policy issue for us. You know, try to solve the so-called information isolated islands. This is the issue. Maybe in the United States already solved, but it's a good news for us. We can learn continually. And the local government also very strong to promote. In regional government in the United States, I think they also have some very similar policies to try to attract the investment. So, and this is not enough. Besides, I would like to emphasize the IP protection issues. So I have only one data. You know, the foreign companies sued the local partners about the IP problems. You know, the success, the win rate is higher than local companies. Yeah, you can check the data. So which means foreign company have more if China protects only all the Chinese companies, it is impossible for foreign company to win in such a high rate. Yeah. And the fifth, Made in China 2025 provide opportunities for China, the world economy, development economy. So, you know, China is in the big countries. It's a fast growing economy and also diversified. So different, you know, quality, different level of products can find their market in China. This is no matter multinationals, small companies, they have their opportunities. So I think when China developed, that is more opportunity than ever, because during the past 40 years already, you know, show these possibilities. You know, look at Zionist multinationals in China. So you can find a general model from United States, how successful in China, and compare to the general models in other countries. And Volkswagen, from Germany, how successful in China this Volkswagen and BMW and so on. So I don't want to raise lots of examples. Last Made in China 2025 emphasize the innovation capacity, the integration of informatization and industrialization, the industrial infrastructure and fundamental capabilities, and 10 key areas with potential breakthrough. All these, you can say this is a threat to the world, global innovation. I think you can imagine. This is open systems. So it's a call for cooperation from the other countries. So these kind of policies provide opportunity for China and for the other countries to cooperation. And are very important. This kind of issue, if solved in China, can provide the experience for the other catching up countries. This is also contribute to the world. So besides, because this emphasizes the fundamental breakthrough, so this is also can contribute to the world science and technologies. I think it's a lot of data. Thank you all.
Dr. Mu, thanks a lot for those comments, and I think it's important to remember that there are some important elements of Made in China 25 that anyone would admire and recognize as China's emphasis on labor-intensive manufacturing leads to reduced profitability. You have to find other sources of productivity growth. And certainly having more advanced technology, and then integrating IT with other industries and other things, all of those things make sense. And they are admirable parts of Made in China 2025 and other parts of Chinese industrial policy. I think the question is then how, what other goals come with the policies, and then how are they implemented? And I think that it is not just the initial starting point, but then how things are implemented that has drawn a lot of attention from foreign companies that operate in China, from governments around the world. And I do think that given that there is this chorus of concern, that we shouldn't see it entirely as just a misunderstanding, that people just have their facts wrong about China, and if they would just really spend more time reading these documents and talking to Chinese officials, they would get it right, and their complaints and concerns would disappear. I think that's probably overstating the question of whether or not there's a misunderstanding. In particular, if you look at the issue of how open and inclusive Made in China 2025 is, if you just think of a few different industries like cloud computing, where a foreign company cannot operate on its own, or in auto sector where you still have to have joint ventures in most places, if you think about autonomous vehicles and the opportunities that are there in China, the chance that anyone will compete with Baidu to have a network that runs autonomous vehicles, the chances of that are zero. If you think about the battery industry for electric cars, only domestic Chinese companies now really have a chance to sell cars, car batteries in China. Japanese companies like Panasonic and South Korean companies like LG and Samsung, they are shut out of the market. And so it's there needs to be a narrowing of that gap between the general principle of openness and inclusiveness and the reality that companies feel in different sectors. But again, I'm not trying to focus on the individual opportunities for companies, but more about the global consequences of what China is doing. And I think that there's a general sense that China's strategy, you know, we say it's the 40th anniversary of the reform and opening era, but I think a big debate that is shown throughout this morning is the reform and opening period still ongoing? And I think there's a big discussion underlying a lot of the conversations, not just on economics, but on security, on the questions about the international system. And I think there's just a disagreement, perhaps more fundamentally, about where China is in relation to the approach of reform and opening. You mentioned, and I think it's important to recognize that lots of countries have set goals for industrial upgrading and for manufacturing. Certainly, the Chinese spend a lot of time scouring the world for good examples. But we know that if you compare in Industry 4.0 from Germany, or even the US's own innovation strategy that the Obama administration came out with in 2011 and updated in 2015, there's a lot of differences both in the content and in the form and the way in which they're implemented. And I would say that the approaches by the United States and its friends in Europe and Asia are more market friendly than China's approach, quite distinctly. Last main point is, I think when I'm in China talking to Chinese officials and companies and experts, I regularly hear complaints domestically in China about the inefficiencies of China's approach and the concerns about overcapacity, hence the need for supply-side reforms and other changes. And I think that when it's a domestic conversation in China, I think there's almost consensus that China needs to do more to create space for private companies, the government needs to, and the party need to withdraw back in their interventions. You need to let banks and financial institutions operate on a more commercial basis. But when you then open up the conversation to look at globally, it seems like Chinese just aren't paying attention to what the global consequences are for these domestic problems, which they admit almost universally. Instead, we hear regular language about win-win, and that everything that is good for China is going to be good for the rest of the world. And the reality is that it's much more complex. Yes, there's lots of benefits, but certainly there are lots of real problems. And I would just encourage folks in China, as you're becoming a world power, really look at the consequences of Chinese industrial policies for those sectors, for the ecosystems that those sectors depend on. Because Chinese growth isn't just about getting shinier, fancier objects that you can show off in cities and on TV and on websites. It's really about improving productivity and efficiency in China. And that is going to come through better economic policies, not just in high-tech space, but in many other industries. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. I remember what you said. Yeah, we will discuss later. But I think, later. Yeah, because I have only 5 minutes. Now I have 4 minutes. So I think, you know, during the past years, and especially recent change, maybe I have to emphasize first to move the barriers for, you know, access to the local market. One example is the Tesla establishing the 100% hold the company in Shanghai. This is one example. And the other is BMW. Yeah, their share increased from 50% to 75%. This is the signal. Yeah, China will continue open to the outside. Second, you know, recently, you know, from the center to the top, to the local government, they have lots of new support policies to the private sectors to ease their the loan process, to ease their administration and some operation process. This is a very good signal. In the future, I think enterprise is still the major, you know, the pillar in the economy, especially the private companies. So I think this is the second point. And the last point I would emphasize, in the future, the value systems play a very important role to dealing this kind of cross-border problems or issues. So I think the equal cooperation, mutual benefit, and win-win will solve such kind of problems or provide the better solution for this kind of debate. Thank you.
So we now turn to you for questions. And once again, please make your questions very clear and directly related to the proposition that we are discussing. And wait for the microphone and identify yourself and ask a question. OK, so we'll start with this gentleman in front. Please make it short.
Good morning.
Wait for the microphone. Thank you.
I thought I had a loud voice. Good morning. Madam Chairman and professors, when Professor Kennedy mentioned about solar panels and that China has better solar panels, I can give you a life example.
No, we don't have time. No. I need a question, and you have 30 seconds.
My question is very simple. My friend has an Atlantic Energy System in Boston. His solar panel, he told me, are in the warehouse, not moving. The Chinese are making me hungry, he says. And then I said, terrible. Weren't your ancestors hungry when they came out of China? He's himself Chinese. And he said, yes. Then I said, terrible. Emperor Xi for life, creating hungry Chinese like you outside of China. So Professor Scott's point is very well made. This is the era of the free market. The question is, what is the American response to the free market?
All right, great.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's a question.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. All right, okay, this woman also at the front table. Excuse me, microphone. Where'd the microphone go? Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
My question is,
Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry. Si Yang, reporter from Voice America. Yeah. My question directed to Mr. Kennedy. And in your 2015 article, you were mentioning that China's Made in China 2025 actually drew inspiration from Germany's Industry 4.0. So my question is, could you elaborate a little bit on the difference between how China implement its policy and how the other countries implement their policies. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take one more. Is there one from this side of the room? Okay, we'll take one from Stan Weeks right over there.
Stan Weeks, SAIC. My question's for Dr. Mu. You've articulately described the China 2025 mutual benefits and broader benefits, but what is the balance, though, in terms of the self-reliance that Scott talked about for China and, not to put it too fine a point on it, the industry dominance coming from that self-reliance? I didn't hear much in your defense on that.
Can you repeat your questions?
One
second. I'm asking about the self-reliance and industry dominance aspects, which I think are what causes much of the worry about Made in 2025, not the mutual benefits you cited.
All right. So I think there's the difference between Industry 4.0 and what the Chinese are doing. We probably need to ask the gentleman who got his PhD in Germany and has this great German accent. As I see it, the way Industry 4.0 was created to deal with a situation in which you have a lot of small and medium-sized, efficient, highly productive German companies, but that have difficulty coordinating with each other and applying informatization to their manufacturing processes. So it was to find ways to promote integration, coordination, connectivity amongst these companies, and apply technologies to what they do, like IoT. So it was a supplement to already a very highly productive economy that was already relatively advanced. That's my impression of it. And I think China's is more of, we lack these technologies fundamentally, and we need to find ways to develop these technologies and figure out how to manufacture them more efficiently. So I think there's that difference sort of in goals and original starting points, and then of course the tools that the German government has used to apply to Industry 4.0 are a lot different than the ones I've described the Chinese using. In terms of the two, challenges in solar, I guess what I would say is, and this gets to the question of what should the U.S. do. I wasn't trying to suggest that China has a great, fantastic, admirable solar industry. It has a very large solar industry because it's driven almost everyone else out of the market. That's the challenge. Now, one of the ways to solve that isn't just about the supply side of whether or not you provide support for companies to innovate and scale up and commercialize. There also has to be potentially a demand side to the solution, right? In the United States, there aren't big tax incentives and other benefits for going solar, right? There's some, and in some parts of the country, but not widely. The same with electric vehicles. You know, why is China going to have millions of these and we don't? The incentives just aren't there. And so I'm not saying that you ought to ram these things down the throats of American consumers and companies, but you have to find ways, if you don't have demand for high technologies in a country, it's hard to say that you're likely to be the innovator for those technologies in the future.
Thank you for your questions. I think the first question is relating to the self-reliance or indigenous innovation. So I think I would like to explain, 12 years ago, 2006, we have a Sino-US symposium on science technology policies. We explain the innovation, so-called zizhu innovation, or some translate indigenous, some translate the independent. But I think all these translations are wrong. So that is because I personally involved in the formulation of this term. I think this term, this is based on the observation, what is the innovation in China. At that time, so 15 years ago, we observed the professor in universities, they conduct their research, follow the hot topics in the other countries, especially in United States. What is published, frequently, easy to be published. They want to do that, because lots of reasons. Second, look at the behavior of the enterprises. So enterprises always, go to the market to see what kind of products are popular, They try to imitate this kind of product, 15 years ago. And the majority, of course, there are some enterprises, they have their own innovation capacity. They can develop advanced products. But in general, that is the normal behaviors. So as a policy analyst, we want to change such kind of situations. So we should first consider the goal of the research, the purpose, the significance of the research, not just work for your own, you know, you want to publish some papers. This is the questions. In order to, you know, change this, so use in the context of Chinese, 自主 means you have to decide to thinking the goal of your research, of your innovations. So that is different from the self-reliance. Self-reliance is different concept. It's in the, you know, the Cold War times, I think. At that times, technology are controlled strictly by developed countries, West countries. Now we have some, you know, some treaty systems, and even today there are some. Even today, you know, United States also have a very strict control about the technology export. It's reasonable. I think that's reasonable because of so-called national security interests and interests. This is reasonable. So if you are facing such a kind of issues, so in a very, you know, specific, you know, situation, you have to say, we have to keep this technology self-reliant, but not all. Anyway, it's global, economic globalization time. So I think this is difference, very certain. But nowadays there are some, you know, because of, you know, look at the data, the technology product export to China decline compared to that 2001. So this is the issue we have to face. Yeah, how to, you know, to improve. I think this is the issue we should face in the future. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a few more questions from the floor. Okay, so this gentleman again.
Hello, Atarv Gupta from Thomas Jefferson High School. Dr. Kennedy, you spoke earlier about South Korea and Japan, and my question is, how can the United States leverage our connections and our allies that are heavy tech producers in the area, in the region, to equalize and create a more competitive tech field, not necessarily to challenge Made in China 2025, but to improve the conditions under which it's implemented?
If there's one more, we will take one more. Anybody else? See any hands? Okay, over there.
Hi, my question is to Scott. You mentioned China may have a problem in the future to make some countries to be ghost countries. I wonder if you have any evidence or example for that, because I have traveled extensively to Asia Pacific region and I don't see any country has that problem. Thank you.
And I'll add one more for you, Dr. Mood, since you didn't address the earlier question. Maybe you can also address whether you think that China's Made in China 2025 program, its industrial policy overall, is similar to or different from Germany's, which was the question that was asked earlier. But
but
we would like, since you spent time in Germany, we'd like to hear your comments as well. So why don't you start?
Okay, I would like to say, you know, my doctor supervisor told me this industry 4.0 is more marketing than technology strategy, because he is also a member of the architect. The architect developed such kind of ideas, because actually, I think, you know, at first, you know, this is an exploration of scientists and engineering in Germany to solve some problems or issues in the futures. So that is what I want to say before answer your questions. For, you know, the implementation of this, you know, you know, first, of course, the politicians accept this concept into, you know, the policies, and there are a lot of, you know, the planning related. But in the industry, you know, there are, you know, they are not so exciting at first, you know, because they already done something. Yeah, this is automation. That is, to some extent, artificial intelligence, and so on. So there can, my friends in Fraunhofer, they also conducted a survey. You know, many people don't know this industry 4.0, even in Germany, at the very beginning. So I think this is, anyway, this is a good step by step. And lots of Chinese visited to Germany and asked the industry 4.0. But they said, industry 4.0, what? But you know, this is what I want to say. Chinese is a very good student. They always follow, you know, the new ideas and try to seek. Now, this is one point. The second point, I think, in China, you know, this is lots of problems we are facing. You know, the productivities, the quality of products, and a lot of you know, environment issues, and a lot of things. So there are also discussion about the automation or these kind of issues, the future factories. But in China, advantage are labor forces. So compared to the other country, we have so many labor forces. If we use all these, you know, automation, artificial intelligence, what advantage we have still? That is the issue in the policy making process. Yeah. So that's it. We have to develop new, you know, ideas, try to solve these kind of problems. So still it's in the some industry, you know, it's in so-called the technology capital intensive industry, they can use this. Maybe the other kind of industry is not so easy. Yeah.
The question of ghost countries. China's one of, I guess, a key feature of Chinese economic industrial policies is to build ahead of demand, right? To anticipate where demand may be in the future, but assume that it will come and have the government and these state-owned enterprises and others assume that risk, to provide political stability and an investment strategy so that others will then follow on. I think that's a key strategy that the Chinese have used. And oftentimes it turns out to be right. They've anticipated demand just right, or they have tracked enough demand. But we've seen in plenty of places in China where that hasn't been the case, where you've gotten bridges or apartment buildings that haven't been used. And I think there's some cases in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, in Sri Lanka and elsewhere, where you've got airports or ports that haven't been used, but they look very beautiful sitting empty. And there are concerns about the debt that is being created through those. I think that's why Malaysia has announced that they are going to suspend implementation of at least 3 or 4 projects that are part of the Belt and Road Initiative. To avoid that problem is going to require a much greater role for civil society and industry in approving the projects to begin with, and then very detailed evaluation systems to figure out which projects work well and which ones did not work well, and then make sure that you adjust. And I think that's certainly possible, and potentially collaboration between the US and China and others, even through AIIB, might help. In terms of what the US can do with its Northeast Asian allies, well, the U.S. is already beginning to cooperate a lot with Japan and the EU. I don't see why we couldn't include South Korea in identifying common concerns we have about Chinese subsidies and ways that we may need to respond in terms of clarified rules on investment and export controls. But I think that's really going to be a transitional step. I think that I disagree with Senator Markey from the beginner. I think whose comments at the beginning about TPP, I think TPP would be really helpful for the United States to join and for us to get as many others to join as well. And I think there are things that we can do at the WTO where we can set rules of the game on high technology that the Chinese would then need to meet. I would much prefer a regional or global solution as opposed to just a purely bilateral one.
Okay, we've come to the end of this session, and we're going to ask you all to vote again, and you can vote even if you didn't vote the first time. I'd like to see more people voting on the proposition that Made in China 2025 and China's broader industrial policy pose a threat to global innovation and the world economy. And while you're all voting, I'll tell you that after this, we are going to take about a 45-minute break for lunch. And please, since there are a lot of people, move expeditiously, grab your lunch, and move out of the way so that others can get their lunch, and be mindful that there are a lot of people who need to eat. We want to make sure there's going to be enough food. I also want to thank my program staff, who have made this conference possible as well. They've worked very hard on preparing this conference and all the research and writing that we do on China Power. Again, if you're not familiar with our website, it's chinapower.csis.org, where we are doing monthly features that dig into various aspects of Chinese power. I also do a podcast every 2 weeks with experts around the world on China. So I'd like to thank my staff, Dr. Matthew Funioli, Kelly Flaherty, and Harry Du, who is running our slides for us. And they're all terrific. Our ideas lab that develops our infographics, also really indispensable. And so I'd really like to thank them all for their hard work and contributions. We now have a final vote, I think, and there has been some change, but still not in the direction of against, where we still have a larger percentage in favor of yes, that made in China. We've gone, I guess, we have gone from 30% to 55%, so we do have a majority. So that's quite a significant shift. And against is 45%. So I want to thank our presenters. It's really been a terrific debate. I hope you all stay with us for this afternoon, where we will have two more propositions, and then we also will have a keynote speech from Admiral Phil Davidson, who will be joining us via VTC from the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command in Honolulu. Thank you. Yeah.